Right then, our study this afternoon, Brother Steve, on the subject, Be Vigilant.
Thanks, Brother Mason, and good afternoon, brothers and sisters, our dear young people. Well, hopefully we're starting to paint a little bit of a picture of Joshua. Hopefully it's a little bit of an insight into the character and personality of the man. And hopefully we're starting to observe that he wasn't just simply a military machine who was going through the land of Canaan and preparing it for the settlement of the tribes of Israel. But he had a deeper personality, a deeper love for his God, and he was a very spiritually minded person. And of course, things didn't always go right for him in life. He had that great promise, as we're introduced in Joshua chapter 1, where God said that he would be with him, that for Joshua to be strong and courageous, and that he would not fail. And so we would expect, as perhaps we did when we were younger, that, well, the pathway to the kingdom is going to be relatively easy and that things will work out as per our plan that we have. And life does take a lot of different directions, and there are challenges that we perhaps not always prepared for. And the same was with the life of Joshua. But it's a wonderful thing to see that each time he confirms his love of God. And you remember in our last study we talked about the defeats in the Battle of Ai and the recovery process. Well, immediately after that, Joshua streams up to Shechem to restate his faith in his God. He doesn't just take his warriors and his soldiers. Unusually, of course, he takes the whole nation. So when we rewind a little bit for the context, back to chapter 8 and verse 30, we talked a little bit in our previous study about Joshua building an altar on Mount Ebal. Of course, Ebal and Gerizim are up at Shechem, which is right up in the north. And as I've said, he didn't just take his army. You'll notice in verse 35 of chapter 8, he takes the women, the little ones, and the strangers as well. So right into the heart of enemy territory, Joshua plunges the women and the children and the little ones, and he goes right up to Shechem to restate and reinforce his faith. Now, militarily, of course, the best option would have been for Joshua to turn south. And while he was on the roll, and of course while victory was his, surely the best thing would be to move his men down into the south and again steamroll through that particular area. But you see, that wasn't Joshua. He was a spiritually minded man, and instead he takes his people, his ecclesia, to a spiritual service, we might say, of renewal, right up north to Shechem. So this was unconquered territory. This is dangerous. This is risky behaviour on the part of Joshua. And we step back and we think, well, why would Joshua take his people all the way up here through to Shechem there? What would be the point of that? Well, when we have a look at it, we notice that they assembled on Mount Gerizim and also on Mount Ebal. Of course, that's referenced to us in verse 33 of chapter 8. And so he got half the tribes on this side, half the tribes here. The Levites with the ark stood in the valley. And he was actually obeying an original command by Moses back in Deuteronomy 11 and Deuteronomy 27. Moses gave instructions to Joshua that when he went over the Jordan, he was to go up to Mount Ebal and Gerizim and make a covenant there with his God. And he was to take all the people with him. So it wasn't something haphazard that Joshua just thought, you know what, I think I'll go for a walk up to Shechem, see what it's like up there. You know, it was a very risky thing, but he was obeying the original command of Moses. And he knew that process of renewal was really important. He didn't just rely on baptism, you know, the type of coming through the River Jordan and say, well, everything's fine. There was that constant process of renewal that Joshua knew was part, an integral part of his life. It's the same with us as brothers and sisters. Sunday morning, for us, is a process of renewal and recommitment for us. Sometimes the week has been difficult. Sometimes we've gone into unknown territory or maybe even risky territory. We come back and we want to replant ourselves in faithfulness to our God. So, of course, he went up to Shechem in obedience to Moses' original command. But it was deeper than that. It was actually deeper because Shechem was a place that stood for separation. Now, there are a number of incidents that happened in Shechem that all focus on this aspect of separation, which is something they had just learned. You know, Achan had gone into Jericho. He'd had a second and a third and a fourth look at this Babylonish garment, of this little idol of gold. He shoved it under his tunic, and that broke down that whole principle of separation. He thought he was going to integrate himself into the world with the worldly dress and the worldly idols. So Joshua is now reinforcing his aspect of separation. So when we look at the events that happened in Shechem, notice really Genesis 12 verse 6, Abraham's first destination. When he came into the land, he was separating himself from everything that had happened in the past, and he received there the great promises. So for Joshua to step there where Abraham had been and receive those great promises was important. And again, Abraham's age was quite similar to what Joshua would have been. It was the place of Jacob's return after 40 years of exile up north with Laban. The place of Dinah's tragic liaison with the world. So you can see this theme of the importance of separation coming through. Where Jacob renewed that process of separation, he told the people to pull off all their earrings and their jewellery, and he buried them under an oak at Shechem. Joseph was buried there with 11 patriarchal fathers. Joshua, we're looking at here in Joshua chapter 8, verse 30, that should be. And also chapter 24, there's a renewal process back at the end of his life. Rehoboam split the kingdom and was crowned king. So again, that process of separation was, in a sense, interesting to see from a national viewpoint by Rehoboam, when the whole nation was separated from the original unity they possessed. And very beautifully, John chapter 4, verse 5, it's here where the woman of Samaria discovered the truth. And her question was, well, our fathers told us that we could worship up in Mount Gerizim. You Jews say in Jerusalem. So again, Jesus had to explain to her the process of separation. Salvation is of the Jews, he said to her. So we notice in verse 30 there of chapter 8 that he built the altar on Mount Ebal. We just have to stop there and think, wait a minute. Why Mount Ebal? Because there was Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. If you know your history, the Mount of Blessings was Mount Gerizim. The Mount of Cursings was Mount Ebal. Why would Joshua construct an altar on Mount Ebal? Well, it was a reminder, of course, of what they just experienced, the curse of the father, the curse of God because of the inappropriate activity of Achan. So they just experienced disappointment, and so Joshua there was going through a process of recovery, and he builds that altar on Mount Ebal. And the other interesting thing was it was an altar. Now, conquerors who streamed through the land of Israel or other parts would often engrave their victories in stone. And so that's very helpful for archaeologists who, of course, can then discern historically what these conquerors had done. Often they were very proud and they'd boast about what they'd done. So it's interesting, isn't it, that Joshua got to Mount Ebal, it wasn't just a big stone about his conquests and how he'd been victorious, and here he is in the heart of the nation. Upon that stone, of course, he wrote the commands of God. And that was the instruction, as we've said, of Moses. So for Joshua, again, we're getting an insight into the man. He wasn't proud. He didn't have a big ego. He was adjusting to the circumstances of life. And he built an altar there. And, of course, what he was trying to do was not simply etch upon the stones his great victory. He was trying to etch upon the hearts of the people a love for God. Parallels very beautifully to Paul's words in 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Paul says, look, I'm not writing this letter to tell you how good I am as an apostle. We don't need to bring letters of recommendation because we appreciate you as brothers and sisters. He says, your lives are the letter written in our hearts. He says, it's a love of God and of Christ is carved not on stone, but on human hearts. And he finishes off by saying, we're confident of this because of our great trust in God through Christ. It's not that we think we can do anything of lasting value by ourselves. Our only power and success comes from God. So the spirit and the attitude of the Apostle Paul as he worked amongst the ecclesias was a mirror of Joshua's attitude as he tried to work with his people. It wasn't just his purpose to get people erect their tents and build cities in Canaan. It was his purpose to create in them a love of God. And that's an important aspect. So there the nation was assembled on Mount Ebal, on Mount Gerizim. There was a natural amphitheatre there. The Ark and the Levites were in the midst, and they recited these blessings and these cursings. And again, you'll notice in verse 33, who Joshua took with him. It says, and all Israel, their elders, officers, judges, priests, Levites, as well as the stranger, they all assembled there in Shechem. And for Joshua, of course, he read all of the law. So it's interesting to look at that aspect of the altar that he built there. We've talked about previously the River Jordan. We talked about the stones that they took to Gilgal as a memorial. There were stones again in the Valley of Achor. So you can see all these memorials that Joshua is planting throughout the land to remind the people of the lessons they should be learning. City of Ai, again, God's promises there. Now on Mount Ebal, God's presence, a reminder of God's presence that it was with them. And in a few chapters, a cave at Machadar where he overcame the kings that opposed him. And finally at Shechem, in his final exhortation again, he puts stone commandments there. So right through the book of Joshua, we have these stone memorials being planted to remind the people of the spiritual dimension that Joshua felt was really important in their lives. So as far as Joshua is concerned, he took all these people, and you notice again, little theme in verse 33, 34, 35, all Israel, all the words of the law, all that was written, all that Moses commanded to all the congregation. So it's a very holistic approach that Joshua took. It wasn't just his soldiers to encourage them in the fight of faith. It was the whole nation. It was brothers and sisters. It was little children as well. So they were all important to Joshua. And he wanted to educate them all, whether they were young or whether they were old, about the importance of having God in their lives. Now, what's particularly interesting, I just want you to come back to Deuteronomy chapter 27, because this is where this original commandment from Moses came, and this is the one that Joshua is fulfilling. Come back to Deuteronomy chapter 27, and you'll notice that here is the command of Moses in this particular chapter. So verse 4, Deuteronomy 27 and verse 4 says, "It shall be when you've gone over the Jordan that you'll set up these stones, which I command you this day in Mount Ebal. Thou shalt plaster them with plaster, build an altar," and of course write the commandments on there so that the people would be particularly familiar with them. So they all assembled, and that commandment was given. The tribes in verse 12 were divided as to which mountain they were going to stand upon. Verse 14 says, "And the Levites shall speak and to say unto all the men of Israel." So here's the opening of the ceremony. Now notice in verse 15 the opening statement. "Cursed be the man that maketh any graven or molten image," i.e. what's just happened? Well, that was Achan. He went into Jericho and he took away a Babylonish garment and a gold idol. And so their opening statement in the prophecy of Moses, "Cursed be the man that maketh any graven or molten image, an abomination of the work of the hands of a craftsman, and," look at this, "puts it in a secret place." And all the people say amen. So here was a very vivid lesson to the people about God's protection and his providence. This incident just happened. Moses prophesied in an amazing way. And there are the people standing up there. The Levites reiterate that and the people say, "Amen, we understand, we accept the circumstance as to how it happened and why it happened." So strategically we say it was a foolish move on the part of Joshua. Come back to Joshua chapter 9, because you notice this was a real risk for Joshua to do this. Because while Joshua was going up to Shechem to renew a covenant with God, look what happens in chapter 9 and verse 1. "It came to pass when all the kings on this side of the Jordan, in the hills, the valleys, the coast, the great sea over against Lebanon, Hittite, Amorite, Canaanite, Perizzite, Hivite, heard thereof," so they'd heard of what happened to Israel, "oh, a bit of a defeat. Oh, look what happened at Ai. They're not the force that we thought they were. They suffered a defeat." So they all gathered together, verse 2, to fight against Joshua. So strategically, as we say, there's proof here that this was a risky behaviour on the part of Joshua. Military foolishness, we might say. But the point is that Joshua always made time to worship God, even if it was inconvenient for him, because he knew there was something even more important than victory. It was a lesson to brothers and sisters: how do we handle defeat? We adjust to the situation of life and we renew our confidence and our faith in our God. And that's the thing that Joshua was trying to educate them in. And to us as well. I mean, we have times when there's Wednesday night classes and, you know, we come along Sunday mornings and people in the world say, "What a waste of time that is. You know, you could be out enjoying yourself." Well, you know what? It might be considered a waste of time for those people in the world, but for us, it's an important time to renew our confidence and our faith in our God. It's why we open our Bibles, because we want to reset our perspective as to what life is all about, where we're going to go. Maybe we've had a rough week. Maybe we've made some bad decisions in 2015. So we want to take the time to open the Word of God and remind us and help ourselves focus on that, to cope with any momentary failure that we might be experiencing. So we turn the page in a sense, and I can imagine that Joshua's thinking, well, that's over and done with, but you know what? This is life, isn't it? Chapter 9 is all about the deceit of the Gibeonites, and perhaps we might say the failure of Joshua really to be aware of that. So, you know, as we turn the page of Joshua, it's not victory after victory, it's adjusting to the difficult circumstances of life. And for God, he never guaranteed Joshua, and he doesn't guarantee us, brothers and sisters and young people, a smooth and victorious passage to the kingdom. And so this is why Joshua is really helpful to us as we start to open up and perhaps get an insight into how Joshua was responding to the situations of life. So both the situations we're looking at, whether it was Jericho, Ai/Achan, where he was attracted outward to the things of the world, or whether it was here in this circumstance in Joshua chapter 9, when the world was sort of drawn inward by Joshua, we need to understand how God responds in those situations. We need to be aware, of course, that when people in the world are attracted to us, as we just read about in Joshua chapter 9, we have to maintain our values and our perspective. Because people in the world see us as committed. They see us as faithful people. They see us as decent and trustworthy people, and that can be an attraction, and it should be an attraction to people in the world. That's how we preach the gospel, by who we are and how we behave and what we talk about. That should be an attractive thing, but it shouldn't distract us from a pathway towards the kingdom. We shouldn't go down to the level of the people that are being attracted towards us. And really, this is the lesson of Joshua chapter 9. So we have a breakdown here, which is quite simple. The nation was, the nations in Canaan were consolidating against Joshua. There was a little bit of camouflage that was happening, very subtle. There was deception. There was infiltration into, we might say, the ecclesia of God, a little bit of an embarrassment, a reversal perhaps, a consideration of what actually happened, and then a compromise by Joshua as he actually embraced and made a faithful covenant with the Gibeonites. So that's a bit of a breakdown of this chapter. Well, who are the Gibeonites? We've read the chapter, we know they're at Gibeon. Who actually are they? Well, they're actually the Hivites. And you notice that in verse 7, it says, the men of Israel said unto the Hivites. Okay, so the Gibeonites are the Hivites. That's their tribe. Now, very specifically, in a couple of Bible passages, God had given commands to Israel they weren't to accept the Hivites, i.e. the Gibeonites, under any circumstances. Because he says, I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite. Well, that's this tribe here. And so they weren't to be part of the original inheritance, as far as God was concerned. Deuteronomy 20, verse 16 to 18, again, look, note this. Thou shalt save alive nothing that breathes, but utterly destroy them, namely Hivites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, that was Hittites first of all, and now the Hivites. So again, very specific commands back in the book of Deuteronomy as to how the nation was to respond to these particular tribes. But there's an interesting twist. Because in this chapter, God is actually reinforcing a promise that was made 500 years before by the people of Israel. So I want you to come back to Genesis chapter 34, because we have the Hivites back here as well, and a promise was made to them. Genesis chapter 34, and it was in that place Shechem, so this would be obviously quite fresh in the mind of the people. Genesis chapter 34, verse 2, this is the situation where Dinah went out and created a liaison with, we might say, the world. Verse 1 says she went out to see the daughters of the land, to mix with the world. What happens? Well, a relationship was established. Verse 2, when Shechem, the son of Hamor, The Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. So a relationship was established by a Hivite. And in fact, the Hivites were descendants of the Canaanites. Genesis 10, verse 17. Well, what happened? We probably know the story. We'll jump across to verse 13. And we notice this happened. The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, i.e. Hivites, his father, well, look at this word, deceitfully, and said because he had defiled Dinah, his sister, well, there were certain things that they wanted to put into place. So deceitfulness had happened. There was a promise given, verse 16, or verse 15 and 16, if you do this, verse 16, then will we give our daughters unto you as we will take your daughters unto us, and we will deal with you, and we will become one people. Interesting, this is the promise given by the family of Jacob, back here in Genesis chapter 34, deceitfulness, a promise to be one people. Again, a little comment in verse 19 about Shechem, this young man, at the end of verse 19, because he was more honourable than all the house of his father. So he was honourable. Verse 21, little comment. These men are peaceable with us. Therefore, let us dwell in the land and trade with them. And let's integrate with these particular people. So there was a promise that was made. And very interestingly, in verse 25, it came to pass on the third day when they saw that the two sons had killed them. And of course, this links across to our study here in Joshua 9. It was the third day that Joshua actually finally completed that promise. So this interesting twist here in Joshua chapter 9 has its foundation back 500 years before when the people of Israel made a promise to the Hivites that they would become one nation. So when we come back to Joshua chapter 9, we'll notice that, or we know the story there, that Joshua made peace with them. So that's an interesting background to this whole chapter. So chapter 9 and verse 1, we're back here in Joshua. Just flip back to chapter 9 and verse 1. Just at the end of that verse it says, heard, this particular word heard. All these kings gathered together, they'd heard what had happened, Joshua's defeat. Previously, in chapter 5 and verse 1, they'd all assembled because they'd heard of Joshua's victory coming over the River Jordan, and it says their hearts melted. So there's an interesting change now in the behaviour of the nation. Now, as chapter 9 and verse 2 says, they gathered together to fight against Israel with one accord. Rotherham says, together as one man. So Joshua's attempt to divide the land, north and south, had really been undone. It was actually Israel that was divided and was in disarray. The margin, if you've got a King James margin, says with one mouth. The Hebrew says with one mouth. So the news went out right through the nation, hey, Israel's had a massive defeat. They're not, as we thought, you know, this amazing victorious army with God behind them, they've all fallen apart. They've had a massive defeat. So this news was mouthed right through the land. So what's the lesson here for us as young people and as brothers and sisters? We've really got to be careful about our behaviour, don't we? I guess as far as young people are concerned, maybe in a few years we'll be marrying a partner, selecting a partner, perhaps even having a family, raising children. Seems a long way off. But, you know, Paul gives us some advice in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 14. He says, the younger women will eventually marry, they'll bear children, they'll guide the house, and they should give no occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. So you see, Paul in the New Testament lifts that same lesson out. He says, if we in our behaviour are unwise, we give opportunity for the world to talk about it and say, well, who are these people that say they love God? Who are these people that say they trust in the Word of God and they understand God's plan and purpose? Look at their behaviour. So you see, this is really the lesson that was happening here in the Old Testament. It's a lesson for us in the New as well. So with one voice, of course, it was now raised and there was resistance against Israel. They were quite weak. So when we go from chapter 9, chapter 10, chapter 11, we see that there was a rebellion and a solid resistance by these nations here in Canaan. This writer makes this interesting comment. He says, ultimately, talking about behaviour and its repercussions, Ultimately, it was Achan's sin that caused the kings of Canaan to unite in their resistance to Israel. Who can say what would have happened had Achan not sinned? Perhaps the battle at Ai would have been Israel's last. As he says, the other nation of Canaan would have responded like Rahab, with perhaps the belief in the one God of Israel, and Israel could have completely occupied the land. It's only with these verses that the reader of Joshua begins to realise the consequences of Achan's sin. The following chapters, 9, 10, 11, etc., introduce the transition from a victorious people of God, whose occupation of the land could have been relatively simple, to an unending history of bloodshed, battle and idolatry that would haunt Israel through its history. So you see, we look at the story of Achan and we think, yeah, we turn the page. This writer, in a profound way, picks up and says, you know what, the threads of Achan's misbehaviour was disastrous for Israel because they had to deal with battle after battle after battle from here on in. So again, we have to be careful not to ruin the reputation, not just of ourselves or of the ecclesia, but of God himself. So these people, as we said, heard of the catastrophe at Ai. Well, the Gibeonites, of course, in between, we notice they're introduced now into the narrative in verse 3 and 4. Verse 4 says they did work willily and went and made out as though they had been ambassadors. So they were quite cunning. NIV says they resorted to a ruse. And our Lord Jesus Christ in Luke 16 and verse 8 says the children of this world are wiser than the children of light. Okay, very subtle. And again, Genesis 3 verse 1 says the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field. It's the same root Hebrew word there in Genesis 3 verse 1. Cunning, but quite shrewd. So we notice, well, what's their plan? Verse 5, well, interestingly, it's an old garment. That's what the record says, doesn't it? Old garments. Well, there's a bit of a thread back to what happened to Achan, because he was attracted by, well, it was a new or a goodly Babylonish garment. Here, the people of Israel led astray by an old garment. What would the old garment be? Well, it was something just in a different form, wasn't it? Really, humanism that had its origins in the serpent's tongue. You know, don't worry about God. It's not important. Does God really know what he's commanding? Look, this might be an easier or a better way. We hear it all the time in today's world. It's the philosophy of this world. So whether it's a new garment or an old garment, we can be distracted sometimes. Well, what was the outcome of all this? Well, there were altogether four cities who were part of the conglomeration of this particular tribe, the Hivites. We call them the Gibeonites because that was the city, that was the main city that made an alignment with Joshua. So here it is. Well, the map's a little bit light, but Jericho's here. Gilgal, normal camp was here. Seen up to the north, here's Bethel and Ai. And of course, here's the whole of this central area of Canaan who is going to make an alignment with Joshua. So they've travelled, of course, well, it's just a mere 25-30 k's. They made out as though they were people from a long, long way away. Of course, when they're introduced to Joshua, their clothing looks very old. They look as though they've been travelling for years and years. Their clothing is torn and worn out. Maybe they even timed it so they came at night time into the camp, so sort of it was dusk and, you know, it was hard to see who they were. All their food is dry and crumbly. They didn't bath maybe for a week or something, and you know, throw a bit more dirt on me, we'll trick these Hebrews. So, you know, they had all the visuals with which to deceive Joshua and the men of Israel. So you notice in verse 6, there's an emphasis here, and their opening statement says, we're from a very far country. You notice that in verse 6, here's their opening statement, we become from a far country. It's repeated in verse 9, verse 11 and verse 13. So they're emphasising we've been on a very, very long journey. You know why? Because Joshua would identify with that immediately. He'd been 40 years on a long journey, hadn't he? Joshua knew what it was like to be on a long journey because he thought he was going to get into the land of Israel when they first went up 2 years after exiting Egypt. Instead, it had been a very long journey for Joshua. So already he's by the subtle words of the Gibeonites, Josh is thinking, well, you know what? I can identify with that. I've been on a long journey too, and it's been tough. Well, the Israelites are a little bit suspicious in verse 7, so they say, well, wait a minute, maybe you guys are from around here somewhere. Well, they never answer that question, do they? They never answer that question. In fact, the Gibeonites were great talkers. You'll notice the Israelites only had one verse, verse 7. They asked one question, and then the Israelites in verse 7 asked one question, but the Gibeonites went on from verse 8 right through to verse 13. So something like seven verses. So they're really, really good and skillful talkers. And of course, one of the other little themes that runs through is we are your servants. So, you know, there's a lot of subtlety in the way that they're talking to Joshua. They've done a lot of homework. In fact, they seem to know more about the law of Moses than perhaps we give them credit. So you notice this. In Deuteronomy 20, Moses gave instructions to Israel as to how they would treat people when they came in the land. Verse 10, 11, he says, when you come nigh to a city to fight against it, proclaim peace, give them an opportunity, and if they make an answer of peace and open to thee, then it shall be that all the people should be tributaries or servants to you. Verse 15 says, thus shalt they do to all the cities which are far off. So this was a restriction. It was for cities far off, not for the local area of Canaan. But these people obviously seem to be quite familiar. Maybe they'd been up to Shechem and looked at the law that Joshua had engraved there, read it, they'd done their intelligence work, they seem to know what they're saying on. So they opened up with an appeal for peace. We are thy servants, verse 8. We are thy servants, verse 9. We are your servants, verse 11. And they also emphasise, particularly in verse 9, we're from a very far country and we come because of the name of Yahweh, your God. So these weren't people that are ignorant. They've done a lot of homework. Their wording is very precise and very carefully executed as far as they were concerned. And they talk about God. They talk about his reputation, his character. They say that they respect God. It all sounds so really wonderful. So for Joshua and maybe the elders, they're thinking, these people seem to have a spiritual side to them, and they're not just, you know, wanting to resist us and rebel against us, and, well, they've offered to be our servants. That sounds quite nice. Maybe we need to think about that. So that statement in verse 9 and 10 is almost a mirror statement of Rahab's statement of faith. Done a lot of homework. There's no mention of where they came from. And they've really undermined Joshua's defence. This gives us a little bit of an insight into Joshua, doesn't it? Because we often think a commander is a man who is quite decisive, he's quite harsh. You know, if his men aren't obeying him, well, then they'll be put out and they'll be punished. Often we think to be a commander, you have to be that sort of a person. You have to be out there and quite confronting to people. Well, this gives us a bit of an insight. Joshua, again, is not that hard-hearted man that perhaps we felt. He's not an unmerciful and cruel leader of the nation. He was taken off guard by what appeared to be an acceptance of the God of Israel. And sometimes that can be the case with us as well. And you notice that there is this constant reference to make a league with us. Five times pressure was on Joshua. We want to make peace with you. What does that mean to us as young people in 2015? Well, in the Old Testament, of course, there was quite a deal of confirmation about relationships and who we should make leagues with and why we should. And right from Genesis chapter 6 and verse 2, again, there was an inappropriate connection to the world because they had a set of different values. And because of that, it led to the deterioration of the truth. Genesis 24, Deuteronomy 7, Numbers 36. So there were restrictions in the Old Testament about making leagues, permanent leagues or relationships with those who don't visualise the truth as we see it. And again, duplicated across in the New Testament. So as young people, we've got to be really, really careful about this. 1 Corinthians 7, 1 Corinthians 11, 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14. Why do we need to do that? What is the reason for that? Well, maybe we could give a demonstration. So I need a young guy and a young girl.
up here, who's, and you've probably seen this before, and I've seen it before, but I've never seen six of it. I actually jumped up there myself earlier, so it was all good. So, good, excellent, look at this. Fine human specimen. So, you need to come here, and this can't, you can't, yeah, did you notice he turned around? Oh, my God. See, it's impossible, if we have a different set of values, to pull... Well, it's not impossible. It is very, very difficult. Okay? Now, it's not impossible, because I know within the truth we have couples that have sort of come into the truth. There's been one partner that's been in the ecclesia, another that's come from outside the world. And that's fine if both of their values are on the same plane and they're facing the same way and they're completely open and transparent as far as their hearts and minds are concerned. That's great. It's workable. But when there's completely different values, it's impossible to walk in the same direction. And this is exactly what Joshua is talking about. It's very risky, very difficult. And so we have to be very careful as to who we make leagues and promises to as far as our personal lives are concerned. So that was the ruse of the Gibeonites. They actually had different values. I'm going to show you through the chapter how they actually became very, very faithful to God. And it's a wonderful end to the story. But for the moment, we're looking at verse 12 and 13. Just in case the Israelites haven't been convinced, they pull out the visual aids, right? What do they pull out? Well, they got bread and it's all mouldy. Have a feel of it. We've been travelling a long time. Look at this bread. Touch it. Taste it. In verse 14, it says, the men took of their victuals. That word took actually means they tasted. Hebrew lakwak. It means it doesn't just examine it, they actually ate it. So I guess they did the taste test. Yes, it is mouldy. Yes, it tastes disgusting. And that's the sort of the thing that the world does to us, doesn't it? I mean, 2015, we live in a massive age where there's entertainment plus visual aids like you've never ever had before, and we're all distracted by it. And it's the way of the world, isn't it? Look at this stuff. Look what we can offer you. Isn't it exciting? Isn't it inviting? And we all get distracted and off we go. And bang, we've broken our league with our God. Well, taste it, they said. Taste this. So the verse says, in verse 14, the men tasted of their victuals, and look at the next phrase, asked not counsel at the mouth of Yahweh. They relied on their own mouths. Well, they'd read their Bible a few days before up at Shechem, but they didn't think this was a big deal because, well, they weren't on a battlefield. It wasn't physically hard, and these people looked as though they respected God. So for Joshua, there was compliance, there was acquisition, there was submission, there was acceptance. And again, I think this is a great insight into Joshua. You know what? He's 80 years of age and he's still making mistakes. I mean, I have a huge respect for Joshua. I think he's an amazing and a wonderful man of God. But at 80 years of age, brothers and sisters and young people, he was still making mistakes, and that's life. And those of us that, well, I don't see anyone who's 80, but, you know, we realise as we get older, we don't always walk the straight and narrow pathway, do we? And I find it comforting that even this wonderful man of God, who had a love in his heart that was extremely deep, at the age of 80 could make a mistake, but brothers and sisters, he could recover from that as well. I think that gives us all some encouragement. For the moment, he is walking by his sight and not by his faith. And we've all been there. And we need to acknowledge the words of the Proverbs. In all our ways, we acknowledge the Father. So for Joshua and for his elders, in making that decision, they didn't actually seek the counsel of God. I wonder if we do, brothers and sisters, in our own lives. There's nothing that's unimportant. There are situations where we need to, each day, talk to the Father about our lives, the big aspects and the small aspects, because sometimes it's the small aspects that undermine the foundation of our faith. We let things go. We feel comfortable. We feel confident that we can handle a situation, and something gets in under the door, realise that we've gone down a wrong pathway. So as far as this little overhead says, sometimes we think things are unimportant. Everything, strictly speaking, should be the subject of prayer, not necessarily a formal prayer. There might be situations where we just want to express to the Father our need and our desire for his strength. Paul says, pray without ceasing, and we need to acquire the habit of a continual approach to the Father in prayer. That habit is only gained by perseverance, for only he who has attained it can truly be said to walk with God. So it's perhaps a reminder for us of how important prayer is. And perhaps you've had experiences in your life where you look back on that experience, you think, you know what, I should have prayed about that a little bit more fervently. I can remember many years ago, we were at a youth conference, and there was a young girl who had a cardiac arrest. We're on a hike, a fairly long hike, and some of the young fellas raced back and said, hey, there's a girl, cardiac arrest, none of our phones are working because we're in the bush. We had no satellite or phone connection. And as hosts, we didn't know what to do. But, you know, as the kids got on the bus, and I think there was about 12 buses, every time we gave a prayer to the Father because we wanted to impress the young people, hey, this is a circumstance, we need to bring the Father into it. So we would pray, we don't know what's going on, Heavenly Father, but please be with this young girl, and we hope that recovery process happens. So that's what we're talking about, you know, prayer in difficult circumstances. Often we leave it, we think, oh, I don't know what to do there, and we don't really visit that as we should consistently. And for Joshua, they ask not counsel at the mouth of Yahweh. Well, in a very beautiful way, though, there was a positive outcome from this circumstance. We think, this is dangerous stuff. What was the outcome? Well, you know, beautifully, Paul in Romans says that God can work all things for good. And he does. Sometimes, young people, we make bad mistakes. You know, our Father is so loving that he will come into those mistakes and he'll try and turn them around and use them as helpful tools for us to learn by experiences and walk toward the King. He did this with this circumstance. Here's four positive lessons. It was a positive result for Israel because the possibility of making further treaties of peace was eliminated. They realised they made a mistake. Hey, let's not do that again, fellas. Chapter 11 of Joshua and verse 19 and 20 says, there was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel save the Hivites. So that was a cut-off point. They realised the mistake they made and they didn't make it again. It was a positive result for the warriors. The weakness of having to confront each city would have wear them out. Instead of having to defeat five cities one by one, God embraced or helped Joshua to conquer them all at one time and accelerated the conquest of Canaan. So there was a consolidation of five cities. Joshua didn't have to battle it out at every single city. By this circumstance, he was able to move through the land quicker. Thirdly, it was a positive result for Joshua. The weakness of allowing human wisdom to make the determinations was removed. Joshua regained his strategic position and rebuilt his reliance on God's counsel. That was the message for Joshua. And fourthly, it was actually a positive result for the Gibeonites. They presumed they could outmaneuver Joshua, but they eventually gained more than they asked for and were absorbed into the nation, performing a faithful service. So we're going to talk about that a little bit later on, Joshua chapter 10. So they were actually neighbours, and as far as Joshua is concerned, he realised his mistake, and yet he made an alliance with them that if they wanted to become part of the nation, then they would serve God. And again, that was one thing that he felt was quite important. So the fact that Joshua made this particular promise to these people is quite important as well. And Joshua kept that promise, and he fulfilled that in a very wonderful way. So as far as promises are concerned, of course, God counts our promises as important. We tend to sometimes think the commitment of baptism, well, you know, I've made mistakes, but big deal. Well, it's a promise of faithfulness for life and beyond. And I often say to young people who are coming through for baptism, I say, do you realise this commitment could be for another 10 years or 20 years? In fact, the commitment you're making to your God is for 1,000 years and beyond. So when you're baptised, it's not just, well, as long as I can sustain myself for 2 years, I'll be okay. When you're baptised, you're saying, I love the principles and values of God so much. I love what Jesus Christ has done for me. I want to be part of the kingdom, which I know is going to go for 1,000 years, and I want to serve God for another 1,000 years and beyond. So that's the commitment we're making. Pretty serious, huh? It's not just a matter of, you know, oh, well, everyone's doing it, so I need to be baptised. It's actually committing in faithfulness to God and his principles and values for 1,000 years and beyond. It's a fabulous commitment to make, isn't it? It's a promise that is amazing. So Numbers 30 and verse 2, Deuteronomy 23 verse 21, God accounts our promises and our vows as very, very serious. And so, of course, here, Ecclesiastes 5 verse 4 to 6, God doesn't like fools. So don't be slow to keep your promises to God. The writer says it's better not to make a promise at all than to make one and not keep it. Don't let your mouth get you in trouble, and don't say to the, and the King James says angel, so there's probably this concept of the judgment seat, and we're talking to our angel, and he says, well, you promised at baptism to be faithful to your God, didn't you? So, well, yeah, I sort of promised, but it was, you know, 20-25%, you know, it wasn't 100%, was it? So we need to be very careful. These are the promises that we make, a vow to serve faithfully our God. We need to commit to that as much as we can. Yes, we're going to make mistakes, but we need to renew and recalibrate our lives carefully. Hebrews 6, verse 17 to 18, God puts his character and his personality and his name as a stamp of a guarantee of his faithfulness. That's why we love God. That's why we worship him, because he is 100% consistent and faithful. That's why we love him. He's unchanging, and in a world of changeableness, that's something that gives us solid confidence. So, young people, that's something that we can definitely embrace and be positive about. So they're the promises of God. So what happened to these Gibeonites? What happened to these Hivites? Well, if we fast forward through history, you'll remember in the reign of Saul, he tried to exterminate the Gibeonites. And you'll remember that there was a famine in the days of David. And Yahweh gave the answer when David said, what's this famine for? And he said, well, because of the Gibeonites. Saul tried to exterminate them. Remember when Saul was a little bit upset with David, and there was an extermination, an execution of the priests at Nob, and 85 priests died, and the record says, and he killed all the women and the children as well. This was Saul. Well, the Gibeonites were actually servants to the tabernacle. So they would have been in that particular location as well. So they would have suffered extermination. God accounts promises as absolute. So the promise and the commitment of Joshua was to be upheld by the nation. So 500 years later, Saul's action was the result of 3 years of famine because of Joshua's promise to protect and to keep the Gibeonites. So God's promises are absolute. Well, Joshua made a league with them in verse 21, and he said, let them live, but let them be hewers of wood and drawers of water unto the congregation, as the princes have promised them. And so the only other reference to hewers of wood and drawers of water is in Deuteronomy chapter 29. Interesting. In that particular chapter, this word covenant and promise is emphasised over 10 times. So Joshua takes a phrase from Deuteronomy 29 and says, well, they can be hewers of wood and drawers of water for the service of the tabernacle. And he takes that from Deuteronomy 29, which talks about the promise, the absolute promises and the oaths of God, how consistent they were. And, of course, Joshua, in verse 23, the end of verse 23, says, for the house of my God. He repeats that again in verse 27. For the altar of Yahweh unto this day. So he embraced them as long as their values became the same as the nations, as long as their spiritual values were the same as his. So there was acceptance of that. And of course, when we look at the statement of faith by the Gibeonites, we notice they say, yes, we accept that Yahweh is the God of Israel. We respect Moses. There in verse 24, if you read that, we respect Moses, the servant of God. We acknowledge that Yahweh has promised you the land. We believe Yahweh will fulfill his promise. We are prepared to live a life of service. And we accept that this is good and right. So they actually give a little statement of faith to Joshua and say, yes, we accept all that you have said. And it may be a menial service. I mean, who wants to chop wood and bring water? What sort of menial service is that? They were accepting of that. And you know what is so beautiful? These people remained as a faithful tribe or a faithful group or a faithful family to God in their service. They did that from the time of Joshua for another 1,000 years. You know that? For another 1,000 years, these Gibeonites were faithful, because there's a record there in Nehemiah when they were repairing the walls. 1,000 years later, I mean, the people of Israel had their kings, had been taken off into captivity. Ezra and Nehemiah came back, and the Gibeonites, or slash, they were called the Nethinims, came back as well. And there's a record of a Gibeonite in Nehemiah 3 and verse 7 helping to repair the walls of Jerusalem. Isn't that great? Faithful for 1,000 years. You know, we have families, and sometimes we're a little bit worried about our children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren. Are they still going to hold on to the truth? Well, this people did for 1,000 years. Absolutely fantastic. And again, we can trace their history. They're actually called Nethinims in both Ezra and Nehemiah. Nethinims means those who are given to God. So they became very faithful. And there's the history there. And in that quotation, again, in Nehemiah chapter 10, verse 28 and 29, it says they came back, they worked with Nehemiah, and it says every one of them having knowledge and understanding. So they retained their faithfulness for 1,000 years. That is astounding, and that is wonderful. So God, in a sense, blessed the Gibeonites, and he made them a blessing for Israel. So what's the lesson to us young people and brothers and sisters? It doesn't matter our background. You know, some of us don't have parents in the truth or partners in the truth. Some of us come through very difficult backgrounds, maybe even abusive backgrounds. We don't have to carry that burden, because it doesn't matter what our background is. For the Gibeonites, I mean, they were decided by God that they should be wiped out. But there was a faithfulness in them which God loved, and he embraced them, and they became helpers to the nation for another 1,000 years. They became examples of faithfulness and dedication. So it doesn't matter where we've come from, what we've been involved in. We all fall short, but there's a new beginning for us all. This is the story of Joshua. They've come out of the wilderness, crossed the Jordan. There's a new beginning for lots of different people. So it's a story of deceit and defeat, but it ends in a very beautiful way in a legacy of faithfulness. What's the lesson to us? We can cross rivers. We can climb mountains. We can conquer the enemy. And we can show our faithfulness to our God as long as we remain vigilant to his principles and precepts.